I am going to go ahead and turn it over to Robbie momentarily. I just want to have a quick reminder about our visiting teacher, Don Hendrick, this week, starting on Thursday and for the next 4 Thursdays. So if you're interested in that and you haven't already done so, you can register online. It's virtual, so it'll be on Zoom. And he'll be teaching the next 4 Thursdays. So Thursday, July 1st, 8th, 15th, and 22nd. So please join us for that. And at this time, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Robbie now.
Okay, thank you. Good evening, everyone. This is our third session in the Discovering Buddhism module of relating to the spiritual teacher or the spiritual guide. We'll go from 7 to 8 o'clock tonight. There will be no class next week because that's when many people are celebrating their July 4th holiday. And then we'll have two more sessions after that to wind this module up. And I would just like to put in a word encouraging people to participate in Don Hendrick's teachings if you have the opportunity. He's a wonderful teacher. He's a resident at the, he's a, not a monastic, he's a Western student, but a very serious one who's been studying Tibetan Buddhism for many years. And he completed the 3-year master's program in Tibetan studies at Institute Lama Tsongkhapa in Italy, which is an FPMT center also. And he's a resident teacher at our center in Santa Fe, and he's been to Kadampa Center several times. And now we get them via the internet. So highly recommended. I'll just put a little plug in also that we're talking about the spiritual teacher and how to relate to spiritual teachers. And one of the advantages of being a member or coming to Kadampa Center is that you get exposure to lots of teachers, both those who are here at the center and those who are visiting. All the way from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Venerable Rabina, other monastics, distinguished Western teachers like Don Hendrick, and then our resident teachers, Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sampo. And as we talked about several classes ago, not every teacher is the right teacher for every student. You don't feel like you have to relate personally to every teacher that you're exposed to at Kadampa Center. So there a lot of advantages to going to teachers to going to teachings by different people. And you'll probably find that there are one or two that you come across over several years that speak to you personally, and you want to pay more attention to their teachings. And that's great. There's no obligation to relate tightly or closely to every teacher that you come across. It's a very individual matter, which is the whole point of this module. So tonight we'll start with our prayers. So if Linda, you want to bring those up, please. I'm getting a lot of rain here. Well, the sun shines. Yeah, interesting. Okay, and I will read these, and you can mute yourself and read along at home. We'll do Refuge and Bodhicitta 3 times, 4 Immeasurables and the Short Mandala Offering 1 time each. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends or hatred for enemies. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayam. Okay, now we will do our first meditation of the evening. We've had some practice with this. First, we'll establish our posture. Most of us are sitting in a chair in front of our computers. So we don't slump back in the chair. So we sit straight, our back a little bit straighter than usual, not rigid, but it's a regal sort of posture. Our head may be just a couple degrees in front of the vertical. Our eyes either lightly closed or just very slightly open so that a little bit of light comes in and just stimulates the retina. If you have problems with sleepiness during meditation, you might want to try leaving your eyes open just a little bit. Our lips are lightly closed, not clenched. Our tongue is against the roof of our mouth, just above our upper teeth. Our shoulders are down and just a little bit back so that our chest is open, and this frees the energy channels in front of the spine where various winds, energy winds travel that the consciousness rides upon. That's a whole subject we're not going to get into in this class, but it comes more important in more advanced meditations, but it's good to just practice the physical posture. Our upper arms are away from our chest, our torso, so that air can flow underneath them. Our right hand is on our left hand, with thumbs touching slightly below the navel, representing the union of wisdom and compassion. That is the state of enlightenment. Wisdom being a perception of reality, compassion being the wish that others be free of suffering. The two wings of the bird of enlightenment. And we aim to develop both of those. And our feet are flat on the floor. If we need to put a cushion under our feet, that's fine. So take a moment, scan your posture, identify any areas of tension or discomfort, and address them now so they don't become an issue during the meditation. And we begin our meditation by taking three deep breaths from the abdomen. The stomach expanding on the in-breath and contracting on the out-breath. You do that three times. what this is actually doing is pulling our diaphragm down, and it actually stimulates the vagus nerve so that our pulse becomes a little bit slower and our breathings become a little bit slower. But you don't want to breathe this way for too long because you can cause yourself to faint. So after three breaths like that, you let your breathing just return to its natural pattern. And following up on the prayers that we said before the meditation, we take a moment to really set our motivation, our reason for doing this meditation, and for participating in the class that's to follow. And whatever reason we have is fine. It's just curiosity. That's great. If we just want a little bit of calmness at the end of a crazy day, that's great. But it's said that the most valuable, the most powerful motivation is what's referred to as the bodhicitta motivation, the great mind. And that's the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. There are two parts of it. The wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So we think that I am doing this meditation so that I can become enlightened to benefit others. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that that motivation is really a kind of enlightened self-interest, because the result of that is that we achieve true happiness for ourselves. By aspiring to become enlightened for the benefit of others, the inevitable byproduct of that is our own happiness. So now we'll begin the actual meditation. And generally it's best to have kind of a plan for your meditation. Just don't sit down and try and go blank and just see what happens. Generally in the Tibetan tradition, we enter the meditation with a chosen object and we place our concentration on that. In this meditation, it's simply the breath. But we can meditate on compassion, or the nature of reality, or the nature of karma, or the inevitability of death. But we enter with kind of a plan. I'm going to meditate on this. And we probably set the time. So we'll do 9 minutes of meditation. Concentration on the breath, the physical sensation of the breath in and out through our nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. Breath going in, breath going out. Mind directly perceiving breath. No duality. No separation. We could almost say that during this meditation, the mind and the breath are of the same nature. The mind is completely pervaded by perception of the breath, the physical sensation of the slightly cool air moving in and out through our nostrils. Thank you. And whenever our concentration wanders off, as it inevitably will at some point for most of us, we set the distraction aside, just say, okay, and come back to the breath. Not fiercely, not criticizing ourselves, but very gently. Like when a child wanders off the path, we gently bring them back, holding their hand. And now we can do a brief dedication. We acknowledge by sitting quietly this way and working with our mind, we have made a positive imprint on our consciousness. And may we think, may that positive energy not be lost or dissipated, but may it grow and ripen in a way that ultimately benefits all living beings. And you can relax your concentration. Okay. Say, Linda, did we have any questions come in during the week?
No, okay. Not that I received.
Okay. So I'll leave some time at the end today if any questions come up tonight. Just to review a little bit, we started this module by talking about some characteristics of the relationship between the students and the teacher. We discussed the fact that the relationship is going to be different with every teacher that we encounter. Relationship will change over time. And that one teacher is not necessarily the right teacher for every student. And then we discussed a few of the characteristics. Some of the different teachers we may encounter. There are those teachers that we approach just in what we could call an academic sense. It may be in an actual academic center at the university where we take a class in comparative religion or Buddhism, or we just want clear, cold knowledge, just the facts. We may come to a teaching at Kadampa Center with that attitude, that we're there just to get some facts about Buddhism, and that's perfectly fine. There's no requirement that when you walk in the door at Kadampa Center that you have to approach every teacher as your ultimate guru or lama. If you just want to come and hear what they have to say and evaluate it, that's great. If we move beyond that, we have Dharma instructors, people who have some personal understanding of the teachings of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, the historical Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago. They've studied them and they have some personal experience. And beyond just the facts, they share with you what the teachings mean to them personally, their understanding, their interpretation, they present that, share that with you, and you evaluate that. We may have a meditation instructor or a ritual instructor who's teaching us specifically a specific meditation or a ritual without a lot of Dharma theory behind it necessarily. And then we have the category of what we call our spiritual mentors. There's our refuge teacher, that if we want to follow the Buddha's path, there's our refuge preceptor we take refuge vows with. We have our Mahayana instructors, those who give us bodhisattva vows and teach us about the Mahayana path, the path to complete enlightenment through development of wisdom and in particular of compassion, the bodhicitta aspect. And then we have our tantric masters, if we feel like we're ready for that, where we receive instruction in very specific and elaborate tantric meditations. And this is the highest level of the student, or the most complex, the most powerful, and also in some ways the most dangerous level of the teacher-student relationship, because you really are looking at very deeper aspects of your own being, and you're relating to the tantric master as if he is the living embodiment of all the teachings of the Buddha. So it's a very, very intense, complicated relationship that needs to be entered to with a great deal of thought. And then we'll also hear people refer to their root guru or root teacher, typically is someone that they've taken tantric vows from, but not necessarily. This is the one teacher that speaks to your heart the most deeply and the most profoundly, the one who, just by when he or she speaks, enters into your heart. And that's something that just happens with time. You just become aware of that. It's not any kind of a ceremony you go through, or you don't go up and tell so-and-so, oh, you're my root guru. It's a more private thing than that. So those are the different kinds of teacher or teacher relationships that we may have as we enter into the Buddhist path. And as I said earlier, one of the advantages of having something like Kadampa Center here is we get exposure to lots of teachers, and they may fall into any one of those categories for you, depending upon where you are on your spiritual path. Any teacher can fall into any category with the student, and the relationship between that teacher and that student is going to be unique. So that's the different types of teachers we may encounter. And then last week we talked about some of the qualities that we would hope to bring to our interaction with our teachers as a student. Let's see, there's open mind. I don't have these memorized. This is another one of these lists, but it's just good to be familiar with it. An open mind, common sense, a natural attraction or an interest in the Dharma, an appreciation for the Dharma. We need to look at our motivation, and we need to be emotionally stable. And let's see, what was the last one?
I've got basic sense of ethics.
Yeah, we need a it's the most important one. I couldn't remember that. A basic sense of ethics, not harming self or not harming others, okay? Ethical behavior is basically not harming others, refraining from harming others when the opportunity presents, okay? That's an initial step on the path. And this, hopefully we want to get to the place where we can actively help people. But for most of us, that's difficult a lot of the times because we don't have the necessary wisdom and compassion. But at least if we can start to behave in an ethical manner, which means monitoring our actions of body, things that we do with our body, speech, things that we say, and then most difficult, mind, okay, if we can control our body, our speech, and mind so that we don't harm others or wish to harm them, then that's a very great quality to develop and bring as a student to the relationship. We're stronger in some of these areas than others, okay? And if we're just going to go and sit in the back of a classroom of 200 students at the university just so we can get some facts about Buddhism, these qualities are not all that important. You can certainly do that without living an ethical lifestyle. These qualities become more important as your relationship with the teacher deepens. Okay, so certainly when you enter into a tantric vow with the teacher, you would want to at least attempt to develop all these qualities to some degree. Even if you want to enter into a relationship with a Mahayana teacher or a refuge preceptor, the more of those you've developed, the better. If you're not living an ethical lifestyle, you know, if you're out killing, stealing, and raping during the daytime, and you come to Kadampa Center and listen to teachings at night, your mind is not going to be generally in a place where it can appreciate or get the most benefit from the teachings. Your mind is not going to be calm and peaceful. It's going to be, you know, quite disturbed. So even as, you know, even when we come to Dharma instructions, if we can come in and say, okay, I didn't kill anyone today, at least intentionally, at least I can say that. Okay. I didn't tell an intentional lie. I didn't steal as best as I know of. And her mind has a certain amount of calmness. And again, these other qualities, as we enter into relationships with teachers that become more profound, more vulnerable in a way, the more we've developed those qualities, the better that relationship will go. We're talking about the ideal. Don't punish yourself or browbeat yourself for qualities that you don't have. There's something to aspire to, okay? And the Buddhist point of view is that whatever you aspire to, you can develop that quality in your mind, okay? If you want to have an ethical mind, that is a possibility for all of us, even though it may seem difficult. If you want to have an honest mind or an open mind, that is something we can all achieve by working with our mind. It may be difficult. In the same way, if we want to become enlightened, that is a possibility for each one of us, okay, to completely develop wisdom and compassion in our mind. And that's the really optimistic side of Buddhism, that there are absolutely no limits to what our mind can develop into. There are no limits on the possibilities for any of us. A lot of the time we don't see that. We don't feel that way. And the Buddha would say, that's a delusion, okay? If you think you are stuck with this limited, chaotic mind, that is a delusion. That is a misinterpretation of reality. That is not seeing your own mind accurately. Buddha said the potential to develop any quality we want is there in the mind of each one of us. That's kind of the big picture. But even just as a student, the possibility of developing these qualities is there for each of us. So that's what we kind of aspire to as a student. And at the same time that we're developing those qualities in our own mind, we are looking at possible teachers and we're evaluating them, you know, not in a necessarily harsh, judgmental, good or bad sort of way, but we're looking for someone who has the qualities that we want in a teacher. Now, if we're just going enrolling in a class in comparative religion at the university, it may just be because we need the credit and it's in the right time slot and it works with our schedule. And we don't care who's sitting up there. We may, you know, read some evaluations of the course and see if this is someone that we think we would like to teach us. But it's not real important at that level. But again, it's more, as we progress through these levels of teachers, it's more important to look at them, we could say, critically, in a sense of evaluating, not in being harshly critical, but really being clear-eyed and bringing our common sense and our innate wisdom to saying, is this someone that I want as a teacher? Again, if it's just for Dharma instruction, not super important, but, you know, you don't want to take, you probably wouldn't get much from the course if it's someone that you actively do not, or that you actively dislike for some specific reason. But certainly by the time we get to a refuge instructor, a Mahayana instructor, a tantric master, it is important to look closely at them and say, do I want this person as my teacher? And there is no obligation to take anyone in the Buddhist world as your teacher if it doesn't feel right for you. Okay? This is an individual judgment and you have to be very honest with yourself. Because we've certainly all heard horror stories, or some of us have, I don't want to describe them, of student-teacher relationships in Buddhist communities that have gone very, very wrong, as they have in just about every religious tradition, I think. And that, you know, I can't say exactly why it happens, but you have to imagine that some of those students did not look closely at that person before they decided they were going to be their teacher, okay? That they rushed into the situation. They ignored their common sense. They ignored their innate wisdom, okay? So it's very important as we progress along the path to look carefully. But there are some guidelines as for things we can look for. That in general, these are characteristics that you would look for in a teacher. And the first one, just like with a student, is this teacher living a life, an ethical lifestyle, as best as we can tell? And again, this doesn't mean you have to go and sit down and quiz the teacher and you have to follow them around sit outside their house at night and see what happens and they look like who goes in and out. But you get a sense, is this person living an ethical lifestyle? I mean, certainly in some of these bad situations, it's very obvious that the teacher is not living what we think of an ethical lifestyle. Again, a life that is as much as possible about not harming others, okay? Either through actions of body, which refers to killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and so on, words or thoughts, we can't tell, okay? That we have to use some inference, but we can at least look at actions of body and speech. Is this person leading an ethical lifestyle as best as I can determine? Okay, the second quality we look for, does this teacher, he or she, have an ability, have they developed concentration to some degree. In the same way when we sit in our meditation at the beginning of the class, you know, we see that for most of us, our powers of concentration are not great. Again, we cannot read the teacher's mind, but we can infer that they are able to concentrate, that their thoughts follow one another in a seemingly logical pattern, that they're not when they're not in front of a class teaching, but leaving, you know, off the pedestal, they're not running around from point A to point B and back and forth again. So he looks for some qualities of concentration in a teacher. We looked that they purified their disturbing emotions, okay? Or they have at least calmed them. Okay, the disturbing emotions are anger, covetousness, and ignorance. Ignorance meaning a lack of understanding of reality. Anger and covetousness, we can see. Ignorance, again, has to be inferred. And that doesn't mean that they don't speak fiercely or wrathfully at times. It's very common for teachers to assume a wrathful appearance, but we have to kind of think about, is this an angry mind, or is that this someone who is speaking angrily out of compassion? Okay, again, you can fool yourself here, but use your common sense, use your wisdom. We want to look for a teacher who has control of their mind, who has pacified it, who has purified some of their negative tendencies. The next quality we look for, and this is a very obvious one, we want a teacher who knows more than we do. Okay? It may just be for a limited area like a specific meditation practice, or it may be for the highest level of Buddhist teachings on emptiness and tantric practice. I think it's pretty obvious that we don't want a teacher who, if we want to learn the Dharma, we don't want a teacher who knows less about the Dharma than we do. Okay, so that's something that we can pick up on very quickly, I think. We want a teacher who is motivated by the wish to help their students. Okay, a teacher who wants to help their students. And again, this is something we can pick up just by observations. Okay. We want to see a teacher who's motivated by kindness, compassion, patience, all to benefit their students. Okay, so we want a teacher who's motivated to help the students. And then lastly, these general guidelines, it says we should look for a teacher who's not a hypocrite, who doesn't profess to knowledge or powers or abilities that they don't actually have. I mean, you'll certainly find in most of the Tibetan teachers are extremely modest. I mean, I have not, you know, it's hard to think of one who's, you could accuse of being a hypocrite unless you call false, unless they're excessively modest. His Holiness the Dalai Lama always says, I'm just an ordinary monk. You know, he doesn't say, I'm the embodiment of the compassion aspect of the Buddha, which is how a lot of people relate to him. Okay, so you don't want a teacher who's arrogant or who claims to have abilities that they don't have. A teacher who's hypocritical. So, what's not on the list? It's an interesting thing. What's not on the list? Good looking is not on the list. Physical attraction is not. So it's actually said in the teachings that being physically attractive can be used in a compassionate way in that it attracts students to you, but we're not supposed to go out checking out our teachers according to their looks. Good sense of humor, not on the list, though a lot of us look for that, I think. Charisma, not on the list, okay. Some of the greatest Tibetan teachers, to my way of thinking, your initial reaction to is, this person is, I don't know what they're doing, who are they talking to, they don't seem to, you know, they're not projecting anything. So a charismatic personality is not on there. So it's kind of interesting to think what's not on this list. Now the things on the list, again, don't expect perfection, okay? Don't expect every teacher that you're examining and that you feel is there's something there to benefit you is going to have all these qualities to the nth degree. But certainly if you're entering into a Mahayana relationship or a tantric relationship, there should be some of these qualities there. And particularly in a tantric relationship, you should be very convinced that these qualities are there to a significant degree. Because as you enter into that relationship, you see that you begin, as part of the practice, you see the teacher, the guru, as the actual embodiment of the qualities of the Buddha, as your direct connection to those qualities. So this is not a quick process, okay? It doesn't mean that you go walk in the door of Kadampa Center and go to one teaching by a certain teacher and be struck by lightning. I mean, sometimes we do have that feeling, but treat that with a grain of salt. And it said you can take years to check out a teacher. I mean, that may not be practical for most of us, but to be a gradual process, an intentional process, a very thoughtful process. And again, we always have to bring our own sense of ethics to the process. Sometimes we may have teachers who seem to be asking us to do something that's unethical, and we need to be open to that because that is a possibility. And that needs to be something that you don't just follow the teacher blindly, but you pull back and say, no, I'm not going there. If it's someone you already have a student-teacher relationship, at some level, it can be very difficult and traumatic. And sometimes involves saying, I'm just going to step back from this teacher. I'm not going to criticize him or her harshly, but I'm going to say this is not right for me and I'm not going to do what this teacher has asked me to do. So it really comes down to both from the student and from the teacher. Everything depends on ethics is the root, okay, the most important thing. And if either the student or the teacher's behavior is not ethical, then something is amiss and it needs to be addressed. It shouldn't be pushed under the rug. Okay, so again, those qualities, we look for them. They're not going to be, you know, not necessarily be there and to the nth degree, but we should see some aspect of those qualities there. And then it's not mentioned there, but something I think, particularly in the West, is very important. You know, this was, we're not in the monastery on a mountaintop in Tibet where, you know, it's a closed community of 4,000 people and nobody has any privacy and everybody knows everything that everybody else is doing all the time. And so I think to a certain degree it was easier to find a teacher there in that everything was known. There were no secrets. We're in the West and it's much more difficult. So something that other people have said, and I think this is true, we need to look at the teacher's other students. And not in that we expect them to be perfect, okay, not that we want them to be our teachers, but we need to look and see, are they benefiting from the teachings? Is their relationship with this teacher a healthy one? Does the teacher relate to them in what we see as a positive manner? Okay, so it's like, are the teachings of this person producing in his or her students? With the understanding that the students are, you know, they're going to be all over the map. They're not going to be perfect. And if we see a student do something unskillful or unethical, that doesn't necessarily reflect on the teacher. But do we see the students becoming better people over time or trying to become better people over time, at least? Do we see how the teachings of this particular teacher are making a positive impact in others? So I think that's a very useful thing in the West, is to look at the other students of the teacher. Okay, do we have any questions before we do our final meditation?
If you do have any questions, you can unmute and ask, or you can wave. I might not see you, though. If you are watching on YouTube, feel free to put your questions in the chat. I am monitoring that as well.
Okay, let's do our final meditation. Okay. So set your posture. Three deep breaths from the abdomen. Set your motivation. concentration on the breath for a minute. And now we're going to meditate for just a moment on the qualities that we look for in a teacher, or sort of guidelines that can help us. And they're given a list of 7, another one of these lists. These are not the only things that we look for, but this is a helpful checklist. The first is ethical discipline. The second is ability to concentrate. Third, the teacher has purified some of their negative mind states. I may have left this one out. Enthusiasm for teaching. I may have skipped over that one. So enthusiasm and joy for teaching. More knowledge than the student. Motivated to help the students. And a lack of hypocrisy. So every teacher we have is not going to have all these qualities, but they should at least have a few of them. And so the bare minimum is that they have more good qualities than negative qualities. So let's just bring to mind a great teacher we've had, one who has spoken to us personally. It can be a Buddhist teacher, or it may be a teacher of something else. It may have been a school teacher or a hobby, or just someone who we learned from. And not judgmentally, not saying, oh, they're bad for not having that quality. Let's just check them and see which of those qualities they were especially strong in. So just bring a specific person to mind and go through that list and see where they were strong, what made them a teacher, which of those qualities did they have. And you can do a brief dedication. Acknowledge that we've created some positive energy. May that not be lost, but may it ripen in a way that benefits all living beings. Okay. Did I leave out enthusiasm when I was going through the list earlier?
I'm not sure, Robbie, my video is not on.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, Robbie, because I had a list from another class.
Yeah. I think I did. So after having pacified their negative minds, the next quality is joy or enthusiasm for teaching. You know, they're not bored by it. They're not going through the ropes. So that's, add that to the list. Okay. So thank you, everyone. We'll meet again in 2 weeks. I'd like everybody to meditate 6 days a week, again for 10 minutes. First minute, that's your motivation. Couple minutes of concentration. And then bring to mind great teachers you've had and look at them by these qualities. And also, there's other students. What effect did this teacher have on their other students? So that's very important. And look at how you came to decide that this was a good teacher. What you may have had other qualities that you saw that really spoke to you, and that's fine. So just try and look at how we go through this process of choosing teachers, whether it's in Buddhism or anywhere else in our lives. And if you have questions, send them to the week to Linda. Please tune in to Don Hendrick if you get a chance. Wonderful, very knowledgeable. I would say he has a lot of these qualities based on just knowing him as a person. Highly recommended. And have a happy and safe 4th of July weekend.
You too. Thanks, Robbie.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Linda.
Thanks, Linda. Bye. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Linda and Robbie.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone.